Okay, the let's get started today. The I just wanted to tell you that the I mentioned a generator called the well generator, and you can actually go and look at it. Up at the University of Montreal, so it's Canadian random number generator. Just well, not entirely, right?
IRO. So this is the this is up here. So the thing about it is that it's like I have this wonderful program on my computer, and it's called Papers. If you want to know anything about it, then you of course type that word into Google, and type the word papers into Google, it's meaningless, right? You just get everything on the entire internet. And the same thing here, if you just type well into the Google, then so you have to type in well and then some University of Montreal or Université Montréal, I guess, if your keyboard can do. Then, by the way, I should also say that I read a little story for you about this 16 by 16 matrix that they tried to invert. It comes out of a little book by Forman Acton, who was a professor at Princeton. And so I just want to acknowledge that. It's a wonderful little book that I believe is called Miracle Recipes, that works. And then in almost transparent letters, is written usually. And it's sort of a classical piece of literature where he explains to you all the pitfalls that can possibly occur when you try to do something like this. We talked about these random number generators yesterday, and so I thought about having a good random number test. So there is one place in everyday life where they use a mechanical generator, and you've all seen this, and that's of course for lottery numbers. If you go on TV and then when they do the lottery drawing, then they have this big transparent ball, and then these little balls in them, and then they blow air in there, and then at some point they switch a handle, and then one of the balls rolls out. And the reason for that is, of course, this is a slow, we can all agree this is a slow way of generating random numbers, but the point is, of course, that on live TV you can convince all the viewers that this is a truly random process. So my little test for your random number generator, contact the Ontario Lottery and Gaming Commission and persuade them to switch this crystal ball with a computer running your algorithm. Now, if you can do that and convince them and the viewers that there's no bias in your algorithm, then you got it made, right? So, which just goes to show that people care much more about money than they would about results coming out of a physics calculation, but that's the sad state of affairs. Well, maybe we should just all get used to it, right? But so let's try to do an integral with this Monte Carlo method. So we have some integral here from A to B that we want to integrate, right? So again, and we talked about this before then, sort of in my simple-minded manner of doing things, then the integrals here from A to B and f of x, that usually looks fairly benign. So we want to evaluate here the integral from A to B of f of x dx. And then how do we do this? Well, we employ what's called the mean value theorem here. So this is B minus A, and then something that I very suggestively is just going to write as the average of f here. So if I know this, then I can say, well, if I want to evaluate that integral, then instead of doing the clever methods that we talked about, Romberg, Simpson, and so forth, then I could actually just take and evaluate f here, or the average of f, by simply throwing down random numbers. So I throw down, let's say, big N random numbers, and then simply evaluate the function in those points. Okay? And you can see that this seems very brutal, right? And clearly, it's difficult to see that this is going to be of any great use. But it actually turns out that you can make this work for you. So when we look now at this, then I can generate, or I can try to estimate some error bar on this. And so what I would be doing here is I would be calculating not only the average of f, but also its second moment. And then, so maybe this is not, well, take a square root of that and then say that this here would give us something that would be equivalent to an error bar on this mean of f. So I can, in this case, evaluate the integral here and get some error bar on it. And let me just point something out that we already started talking about. When I do it this way, then I assume that the xi's are independent. And hence, I can use some central limit theorem and say that I can estimate the error bars like this. So we're not going to do the last tutorial today. We're going to do it tomorrow, right? Yeah. So you'll be trying this for the T9. Yes. Well, you know, if you want to put an N, then you can do this. It's the standard way of doing the standard statistical, the standard deviation of the means that you should define. N here is simply going to be 100,000 if you want to divide by something that's N instead of N minus 1. Then we can do that. So far, so good here. So you look at this, and then you say to yourself, well, is there a case where this would be more or less exact? So can you think of a function that we could be integrating where this would actually give us a fairly good result? Yeah, so I can maybe look and say this here would at least work well. It may not be very interesting
f of x here is close to a constant. And then you can ask yourself, well, why would I be calculating integrals of a constant? And that's, of course, a different question. But clearly, if f here is close to a constant, then the standard deviation, and so this is actually, well, that should be the s dom here. This is the standard deviation of the mean. The variance is this one. So this would give us a very small number because f squared and f are going to come out to be the same. So you can probably see where this is going because yesterday we talked about the fact that I could take numbers that were generated uniformly and then actually transform them so we obtain numbers that are not uniformly generated. And that goes by the name of important sampling. So I have a, if I can find my, yeah. So let's have a look at that. So this is what we want to do here. And then we want to get, we want to improve on it. We're not really being clever yet. So I want to introduce something that I call important sampling. And the importance, or the reason why this is called important sampling, that's simply imagine that I have a function which is sort of very sharply peaked here in my interval from A to B. Then when I want to calculate the average of F here, it would seem a waste of time to spend a lot of the random numbers out in the wings of F of X where the distribution or the function is largely zero. So the reason why this is of interest to us is that a number of integrals that you might be doing, and you could also think about evaluating partition function, you know that in the end they're going to be fairly sharply peaked. And hence, you should not just think about a function that's completely flat. So I look at this. And then, as we talked about yesterday, I suppose I have a g of x, which is a probability density that's normalized on a to b, for which I can generate random numbers. And that is the g minus 1, the inverse of the cumulative function. I know what that is. And I can use that. OK. But now here I have f of x instead. So when I look at the integral here, I from a to b of f of x dx, then I could get the idea that, well, maybe instead I should do the integral from a to b here of f of x, g of x dx, right? And then you can probably see where this is going to be going, because I'm going to write this as a to b, f of x, g of x here, and then the big G of x. And then I'm going to say here that g of x is the integral from a to x of little g of t dt. Right? So if I look at the expression that I have here, then I can actually say that that should be the integral from g of a here and then up to g of b here. And then inside here, I'm going to get the function evaluated in x, but x here is g inverse on u. And likewise here, I'm going to get a g on g inverse of u here, and then over du. So this I can now then evaluate, because I would then just need to look at the, where's my eraser? I would just need to look at the average now of f of this one here, and then over g of the inverse here. And this I could say, well, I just do it as before here, so I throw down some points here. Let's call them now yi of with a little label of g on them, and then g of yi of g. And so the yi's here are distributed with g of x. So then you see that I can sort of flatten the function that I'm integrating if I can do what, to a certain extent, amounts to a change of variables. Instead of integrating over x, I'm now integrating over u here. And then I need the inverse transform, which is going to give me the density g of x. So then you see, well, now the entire problem is solved, because if I choose here f equal to g, then I'm just integrating 1, right? And so there's only the little problem that so what am I writing here? Because if I choose this one, then well, the s dom on this here is 0, right? So that would solve the problem. However, if I try to do this, I would need big F, which would be the integral from a to x of f of x dx, right? So, and that would of course only also work if I somehow could interpret the function f of x here as a probability density. So we're sort of biting our own tail, because I'm claiming that I could evaluate the integral exactly if I knew an analytical result for the integral. Right, but so there are two things I want to point out here. The first one is that this could still be of considerable use if I had a g of x that was maybe something like this. Maybe the actual function that you want to integrate is close to a Gaussian, and we showed yesterday how I could generate Gaussian numbers.
So maybe you can't get the standard deviation to be zero, but you could get to be fairly close. So that would be good. The other way that one could somehow improve on this is what's called, if I just go back to my original way of doing the integral, if I'm not generating uniform points between 0 and 1, I can do sometimes what's called stratified sampling, where I cut the axis into little intervals and then take some random points in there. So there are various improvements in this, and this is of considerable use. If we compare this to for instance Simpson maybe, and we do this in high-dimensional integral, let's call it D here, then the problem with doing Simpson or trapezoidal is that, as you have already seen, you would take maybe 128 points along the x-axis. If you now assume that you're going to be doing that same kind of integral, but in d dimensions, you would need 128 to the power d to get the same precision. And if you take 128 to any kind of reasonable power, it simply becomes quickly impossible to do that. Whereas if I go up and look at formulas like this, they really don't depend on the dimension that we're in. I could say that this formula here, it should work equally well in two dimensions and three dimensions. So the scaling of the amount of points that I would be using for some kind of Monte Carlo strategy like this one, compared to what I would be doing with Simpson and trapezoidal, is quite different. And the sort of ballpark estimate is that the Monte Carlo integration becomes better for d bigger than 8. If you want to say that it's better for 7 dimension, I don't know. This is not a hard number, of course. Once the Monte Carlo integration becomes better, it quickly becomes quite a bit better. So if we assume here that for your integral the turning point is 8 dimension, then in 12 dimensions the Monte Carlo method would be doing way better than Simpson or trapezoidal. So Alan Sokol has an interesting article on Monte Carlo methods, and he starts it off by saying that he wants to point out that the Monte Carlo method is always a bad method, and he has a certain point in that, because if you start to look at sums like this, then you'll see that there will be an error associated with it, as we just pointed out, and that error will go down only like the square root of n, and that's something that's hard to beat. The point that we're trying to make here is that other methods would be even worse. So now to the so by the way, yeah, for the I have a simple integral which is just the error function. So this one you're also going to try to do for the tutorial tomorrow. So now for the interesting part here. Oh, well, actually, before that, let me show you something else. the I'm going to get totally lost in my notes here. So I just want to have a look at something else because when we look at an integral, then in my mind there isn't a big difference for between an integral and then a sum. So and once we say a sum here, then maybe we could think about some gigantic sum like this one, right? Yes. For this estimate here?
No, for the Monte Carlo.
Up here?
Yeah, how dense do you take your endpoints? How many points?
That depends on your desire. This is a whole industry. You would choose it so that your estimated error bar would be what you desire.
Okay.
And in this case, we have, since I'm assuming that the yi's are independently and uncorrelated, then I should have a fairly good control over the error bar. This is a very interesting point because there are lots of people that are doing Monte Carlo simulations in the financial industry, and they have the challenge that they can't sit around for 10 hours waiting for their Monte Carlo simulation to finish, so they want a Monte Carlo estimate maybe within 10, 15 seconds. And then they actually turn it upside down. So then they say, well, maybe we shouldn't take the yi's here completely random. Maybe I could find other sequences, so-called quasi-random sequences, that would do a better job. And so that's also extensively employed. It's the difficulty with that is that you cannot, once you get a result, immediately increase the precision, because you would have to generate a whole new sequence and so forth. But believe me, controlling the errors and doing something like this is there's a whole industry that would do this. But I just wanted to sort of go through what we did here in when I look at a sum here. So suppose I would like to evaluate a big sum here over some terms, and I'm suggestively going to write sigma j here. So the sum is over j, and j may be a labeling on some configurations that you, for this purpose, could think being the configurations for the Ising spins that you'll be using. So what we're going to do here is we're going to say that f of n here, well, I'm going to approximate it as 1 over m here. So I'm going to take the mean term here. So I'm going to do a sum here from k equal 1 to big M here, and then f of sigma k. So that would lastly be my mean term in the sum here, and then I multiply by big N. In complete analogy with the first way of doing this integral here. So I'm just saying here that the average of f here is nothing but what we would expect it to be. So f of sigma k here. Right? If I look at that, then I could actually turn this around a little bit. So if I look at the sum that I had here, then I would say that the probability for choosing sigma k here, if I just do what I'm doing here, then that probability, let's call it p of sigma k here, that's equal to 1 over n,
So actually, this year that I have there is 1 over P of sigma k. Okay. So what we're saying here is that the expression that I have is 1 over n, and then a sum from k to 1 to m, and then f of sigma k here, and then p of sigma k. Just move this in here. Now, if I take k to be sufficiently large, then I can write this as a sum not over k, but over the actual configurations. So when k here, it goes to infinity, then I get that this here becomes replaced with a sum over some sigma k, and then I get an f here of sigma k, p of sigma k, and then I need to then figure out how often will a configuration occur. So sigma k occurs big M, and then p sigma k times. So I'm going from a sum over k to a sum over sigma k here, then I need to multiply with m p sigma k, and then I had a 1 over m out in front of it. And that, you can see, is just precisely our f of n. So this argument would work for a general different distribution for choosing the configurations sigma k here. So I can go in and do essentially what I do over here. And then, of course, you can see that it becomes the same goal that we just did here. If I can choose the actual configurations precisely with a weight which is f of sigma k, then I've solved the problem. So the question is now, is that actually possible or not? And that brings us to the next trick that was developed. And there's really the idea that they got at Los Alamos in the late 1940s. Let me just try to... What we want is basically points that, well, if I look here, I could do this integral if I could generate points on the x-axis with a distribution f of x. And over here, you can see that I could evaluate sums like this that would be coming from maybe a partition function like this, if I could generate points that would be distributed with the Boltzmann distribution. So the idea here that was developed by a number of people, so Ulam here, von Neumann, Metropolis, Teller, Rosenbluth here, is a very clever idea. Let me give you one way of looking at this. So we substitute in a dynamical process, and it's actually technically what's called a Markov process. Under which the xi's, or over here when I'm doing the sum, or the sigma k's are visited on average with the desired probability. And so, well, let's call it g of xi,
And over here in the example that I had over here was f of sigma k. So if we think in the simplest way of thinking about this is if I wanted to do this integral and I couldn't figure out how to get at a g of x, maybe I could do something else. Maybe I could define some points on the interval here from a to b. And then I could imagine being a little random walker there, which is in a good mood. And then I could think about having that little walker sort of walk up and down the lattice. And the lattice in this case would be some discrete points of my choosing. And then the question is it possible to set up this process for his walking on the lattice so that if you take a snapshot at time t, then wait a long time, take another snapshot, and do this many, many times, then the number of snapshots where he will be standing at point xi will be equal to the desired density or probability density that you're looking for, which is called g of xi. And that sounds like it's a very brilliant idea, in my opinion, to do this. If you like, you're changing the formulation around, because really what you're doing is that you're setting up a Markov process. And if you want to be mathematically strict, you could say that it has no relation to the underlying integral or to the partition function. But you don't really care, because you can prove that in the statistical sense, I can get the same results out of doing this as I would have gotten if I could have evaluated the partition function or the integral exactly, right? So we're gonna try to substitute in a process which would be a random walk here. And that's the idea. And it turns out that the only thing we have to calculate is transition probabilities. So, the probability for being on xi and then going to xj, and then the, or equivalently, the probability for being in configuration k and going to configuration j. And actually, as we will see shortly, and if you looked a little bit at the homework, that is an immensely simpler problem, because I don't have to integrate the function up and determine some cumulative function. Actually, these transition probabilities are just ratios of the desired density. So if we think in terms of this integral, if he is currently standing right at this point here, and I want to take one step over in this direction, then we could probably see that if I set up the transition probability, so I would have a slightly larger probability for be standing here at the maximum compared to going in that direction, then I could get precisely what I wanted. So you can almost guess that the these transition probabilities are just going to be ratios of the functions or ratios of the Boltzmann weights in the 2 points. And I'll show you that in 2 seconds. You with me so far? So the idea is do something completely different that will solve the problem for you. We're going to do or substitute in a Markov process. And I claim that that will solve our little problem here. There is a price to pay for this, and the points visited, let's call them the xi's or the sigma k's here,
are now correlated.
Because they come from if my Markov process is just either going one step ahead or one step back or staying put, then if I know where he is standing right now, then I can with a fairly good probability figuring out the 3 points where he could have been previously, right? So if we looked at how I calculated the error bar for the case where I was able to generate the points on the x-axis with the desired distribution, here I'm going to have to be careful with the error bars. And when you run a Monte Carlo simulation, most of the problems that you will encounter, it stems from this point here. So please keep this in mind that even though I claim that the points here on the x-axis or the points in the configuration space here will be visited with the correct probability, then there is an autocorrelation time in here. There's a real underlying Markov process, a stochastic process that goes on, and I have to wait until my configurations become independent. So let's look at how we would do this. I'll assume here that I have some states, and let's call them S mu here. They could be the points on the x-axis, or they could be the sigma k's here for the easing simulation that you'll do. It doesn't really matter. But we now want to set up this dynamical process here, so I'm walking between them. So eventually I'm going to have to define the probabilities for being at configuration mu here and going to mu. Now, if I sum this over all the places it can go to, including staying put here, then that has to be equal to 1. And then we would say that the equilibrium here, that it's obtained here when the flux is 0, as I would say here. The sum over the probability for being at mu and going to all the possible sites that I can go to is equal to the sum over mu here, and then the probability of being on the other configuration and then coming onto mu. So if you want to think about this, if you think about particles that are moving rigorously on a lattice, then you could say that this would be the number of particles that are leaving the site or the configuration mu, and this here is the number of particles that are coming in. And clearly, if when we obtain a steady state or equilibrium, then the what comes in is equal to what comes out here. So here you can see that I can actually move p mu out here because the sum is over p here. So this here is just equal to p mu. So we're saying here that P mu here is equal to the sum over mu, and then P mu and P mu over mu, right? So I want to look at this in a slightly more abstract manner here. I'm gonna say that suppose suppose I now start with a vector here that we just called P, that would describe the probability for being on any of the configurations mu here, and I label that with some kind of time index for my process, then I could get the same probability density at time step t plus 1 by simply taking this big transition matrix that is described by having all these transition probabilities in there and just applying it to that vector, right? So the conditions here, if I look at this p mu nu here, then that will actually define what's called a stochastic matrix. And we had this expression on the blackboard a little while ago. So I told you about Google's matrix, right? And Google's matrix, they had actually also rigged it, so it was a stochastic matrix, and we were doing precisely this. It wasn't probabilities, even though in the way they were thinking about it that time, it was related to that. And in this case, we looked at the ranks here. So what we want is that eventually I can then do this if I go two steps ahead by squaring this one. And then what we want is, of course, that we somehow obtain equilibrium. So when this process goes on here, then I actually arrive at a probability distribution here, which is, if you like, the eigenvector of the stochastic matrix with eigenvalue 1, right? And this is the one we desire. So we can look at this, and so we. We go back and look at this initial expression that I had over here, and then we say that in order to do this, and I'll tell you a little bit why, this is the equation that I want to play around with. So what you usually do is you satisfy this term by term, and that goes under the name of detailed balance here. And so that would mean that I require that P mu here, and then P mu going to nu here, that actually is equal to P nu and P nu going to mu. So this here is a what's called a sufficient condition, but it's strictly not necessary. So if I imply this detailed balance condition, then actually I do arrive at a well-defined fixed point for my distribution. There's another take on this, and you could be worried that I could have limit cycles occurring. So I could imagine something strange where I would have a p star that would be p squared and then p star. But p star here would be different from p applied to that vector. And you can show that if I impose this detailed balance condition here, then I explicitly rule out this possibility. And curiously, when Brin and Larry Page, they were struggling with the Google matrix, they did precisely the same thing. They actually add a term to the Google matrix so that these limit cycles become ruled out. But this is, so to say, the fundamental equation here that we want to solve. And the way we're going to do it here is that we're going to satisfy it term by term. So if we do that, then we're almost, but not quite, done here. So we also have to satisfy something that's called ergodicity. And I'm not going to talk about this for a lot. I'm just want to point out here that we have to be able to visit all S mu. Okay. So now what we want to do here is I just want to solve this equation here. So from this star here, if we now look at how to choose p mu nu, how should we set up the transition matrix here? Well, we can see that we're going to end up having precisely what I alluded to previously, because the probability for going to mu divided with the probability of going in the inverse direction here, that should just be given by the ratio of the two probabilities. Right. So that's what we want. Mu here. Now, if I go over and I look at what I have over here, suppose I'm thinking about my S mu as being states of the Ising spins, then I'm saying here that the probability for going from mu to nu divided by the probability of going in the inverse direction, it should simply be given by the ratio of these two Boltzmann weights. So that would be E nu minus E mu over KT. And that is often written as E to the minus delta E over KT. At this point, it's very simple to get the sign wrong here. So you have sometimes to go back and look at what how this should work. In this case here, it's only the ratio that's fixed. All right. So my Markov process that I'm trying to set up, it doesn't fix the actual transition probabilities. It's only telling me that the ratio of them, they have to follow basically the ratio of the desired distribution that I want to calculate. And this one I can, of course, calculate very straightforwardly. So when we when we do this, so let's do a concrete example, which is the one that you'll be doing here. The first thing you have to do is you have to decide how to walk. Because nothing in what I told you about so far, I'm not saying anything about what site or what states it could be going to from you here. In principle, it could be all of them, right? Or it could just be a few of them. So for homework number three here, we make the decision, which is the simplest possible one, is that we only go to a configuration that differs in a single spin. Or we stay put. So the way to think about this is that there are going to be, if you have this L by L lattice, if the easing spins, there's going to be then L squared configurations that would differ from the present one in just a single spin. Okay? Would it have worked if I had decided to flip two spins at random? If I go over here and look at it, I would have to calculate an energy difference, which would be the ratio of the two Boltzmann weights, and it would have been simple to do that if I flipped any number of spins. So could we do that? Well, it's a little bit trickier than that, because there's nothing wrong with the idea, but if you look at the number of spins that are pointing up minus the number of spins that are pointing down, and if you always flip two of them, then either that number will always be odd or it will always be even. So if we, in this case, had flipped two spins, then we would actually only be accessing half the total number of configurations. And that might have taken you quite some time to figure out that you were actually violating your rigidity. There are clever ways of doing the Monte Carlo algorithm where you actually flip a great many spins in a single update, but we're not going to talk about it here. So for the present purpose, we can see that if I stay with this single spin flip, then I'm doing this correctly. I can get to all possible configurations. So then I just need to do this transition here. And there are actually several choices for doing this. So how about saying that this here is e to the minus beta, and then e nu minus e mu, and then over e to the minus beta
E nu minus E nu here plus 1. Now, if I look at the ratio where I'm going in the other direction, you can actually quickly see that this here satisfies the criterion that I'm going to get precisely this e to the minus delta e here. So this is sometimes used, and you can rewrite this probability in different ways here. Or you can do something else, which is the one that we proposed that you do for the homework. That's just to say that the p of mu here, I can take it as a minimum of 1, and then e to the minus beta delta e. So if I look at then the probability of going in the other direction here, it would be the minimum of 1 and e to the beta delta e. And if I look at the ratio of these two numbers, if e to the minus beta delta e here is a big number, then I'm going to get a 1 here, and then the ratio here would precisely give me the e to the minus beta e. If this here is a small number, then in the denominator, I'm just going to get a 1. So this here is also clearly okay. So that means that not only are there many ways to do your walk, there are also several ways, given that all we need to satisfy is the ratio of these probabilities. There are also many ways to set up the transition probabilities. So then I claim that when I select it, and here, of course, I'm explicitly talking about the Boltzmann distribution, I claim that the end result is that S mu here is now visited with probability e to the minus epsilon of S mu here, or e of that. And then I go over here, and then I look at this expression here. And then I can start looking at expressions for now how I would calculate things. So if we look at what we would call the thermodynamic average of the energy, it would be a big sum here over all these S mu, and then the energy of this S mu here, and then the Boltzmann weight. Right? Now I'm claiming that I'm visiting points here or configurations precisely with that probability, so I can actually drop that part here. So this becomes walking around between the different configurations, so walking around on the x-axis, visiting the configurations with the desired probability, and that will solve my problem for me. And magically, if you like, when I do something like this, I have somehow circumvented actually calculating the partition function. Okay? So let's just look at this in a little bit more hands-on way. I can think about my Monte Carlo process as now outputting a sequence of states here, and if I look now at the energy of this, all these states, I would get the energy of S mu here, and let's call it S mu t. And then right after that, I get the energy of S mu t plus 1. But if my t here, which is some imaginary time axis for my dynamical process, if that just distinguishes a single spin flip here, then S of mu here and S of mu t plus 1, they could be the same or differ in at most one spin. So that's just going back to the point that I had before. I have correlations. So somehow we would like to get around that. And if I go over and look at the expressions for whatever, you can basically take any kind of thermodynamic expression and then just remove the Boltzmann weight and put a 1 over m in front of it, and things will work out fine. If I look at this and I were to calculate error bars, as we talked about when we did the Monte Carlo integration, then I'm going to have a problem with the error bars. So we need to worry about this. And actually, what is often done is that you you would start here with the energy of S mu here, T here, and then you have to wait for a long time here. And then you get to the energy of a configuration where I have tried to take L squared steps with my dynamical process. And this here is often called one Monte Carlo sweep here. So one talks about an MCS here, which is just L to the power D attempted updates. So I'm trying to tell you here that the these states that you encounter here, they will be correlated. So there will be some kind of autocorrelation times. And
that is usually bigger, and usually much bigger than a Monte Carlo sweep. So the way you would be using this is that you would start your simulation, make one observation of the energy, and then you just let your experiment or your Monte Carlo process run for a while, probably in excess of a single Monte Carlo sweep. So you need many Monte Carlo sweeps, and then you can measure the you can measure the energy again, and then you can hope that these things would be uncorrelated. Okay, so there's going to be an autocorrelation time here, which is tau. Tau here depends on L. And it also depends on T minus TC. So often people do Monte Carlo calculations incorrectly because they look at their data for a small system size away from any critical points that the model would have, and then they apply those estimates to bigger lattices, and in fact they're looking at correlated data. So for the calculation that you're supposed to be doing, then you have to try to get around this by performing what we call measurements that are called the N-step MCS part. Okay. So I point this out when we would think of a temporal axis for the dynamical process, and you would always define that in Monte Carlo sweeps. So when I talk about n step, it's not just flipping a single spin, but it's actually trying to do L squared.
Did I understand correctly that if I implement these loops, and the loop that has NMCS as its upper bound, it's going to go like 5 loops, but each of those is going to contain a loop that's going to go from 1 to L squared?
You know, it's up to you how you write your program.
Yeah.
The what I'm saying is that You will have a temporal axis here, and you would usually measure that in Monte Carlo sweeps. And a Monte Carlo sweep corresponds to L squared updates and updates. Yeah. And when I'm talking about something here, then when I say that you would take n step apart here, it would be n step Monte Carlo sweeps. How you write that in terms of do loops is it's up to you. All I'm trying to point out is that thinking that configurations here that differ in just a single spin flip as independent is clearly wrong. Yes?
Magnetic susceptibilities, it's already a sort of like a standard equation of the energy magnetization. So how do you compute the error bars for those quantities?
Well, you would have to compute the error bars on the next quantum plane. So in order to calculate the error bar on the energy squared, you would need the fourth one. So I can think of it about this as spitting out measurements here of E, and so I can, at a given point here, I can measure the energy, and I can measure the energy squared, I can measure also the energy force, and so forth, and then I can apply error bars to that. But you can see that there's something here which is a little bit tricky, because I'm telling you that that things here are correlated. So if we really wanted to calculate error bars correctly, then we should actually use what's sometimes called gating techniques, or bootstrap techniques, or other methods, and sometimes these are called jacklines or similar things. So there are ways, if I know that my data are correlated, there are statistical methods that would give me better ways of estimating the error loss. In the homework, we're just going to assume here that the error on the energy, I can get it simply using an expression like this. And this only works here because the E of S nu here, there you go. So it's up to you to make sure that you have taken these far enough apart that they're roughly independent. Okay, so if I use this estimate here, and I were to compare it with more advanced estimates, then it can be shown that this here is actually always underestimating your bugs. But, well, for homework, then that'll do the trick. I'll stop here now. So tomorrow I can tell you a little bit more about how you would actually do this. So, but that's the Monte Carlo idea. I hope I managed to convey to you that it's a very neat trick. It's quite unique because you, from the left field, just take this dynamical process and plug it in. And magically, then all these difficult factors, they drop out. And you're sampling something that looks like a flat function. Questions? Questions? Same thing about some questions for tomorrow. Oh, one thing, yeah. So there's this instep in your calculation. There's another thing that you have to play around with that's in normal. So if you just start your Monte Carlo simulation in a random configuration, you need to run your little box here for some time before it has before it's sampling configurations that are distributed according to the Boltzmann distribution. Yes.
Is it better to start with the old spins alike? Like if you are running for a bunch of temperature, if you start with a small temperature, usually they will tend to be all lined up. So if you already say that they are like that, the time to come on is too fast.
Not really. It's very difficult to come up with a good general way of starting from a configuration that will assure you that you have a slow or small warm-up here. It's also very dangerous. I want to say one thing here, and that's for the homework, you shouldn't go too low temperatures. And the reason for that is that if you look at your transition probabilities, you can see that there are some exponentials in minus delta E. If I go way down to low temperatures, then all the transition probabilities are going to go to zero. And that will mean that your little walker, which is walking in state space, he's going to freeze, right? He'll just be standing on the same point forever. And that doesn't change the mathematics. Still, your process is okay. It would just mean that you would have to run for longer and longer and exponentially longer in order to get something that's reasonable. And there's some ways around this, but we're not going to. Yeah, what do you want to?
Sorry, not really.
No, I was just going to say, yes. So there are better ways of doing Monte Carlo at very low temperatures, but we can't do everything for the homework. But you should just realize that things may look odd if you go down to very low temperatures.
Yeah. Question? I actually saw this statement, but we just found how to fix Knoebler, if anyone's interested.
Okay.
Sorry, because when we used plot stuff, and we all been having problems. Knoebler doesn't seem to work on our
track. You should just use XS Waves, which is apparently installed. And
it tends to crash quite quickly. But if you go to System Preferences, Assistive Technologies, and disable Assistive Technologies, then Knoebler runs fine. And you can just save everything that's got that instead of going through both.
Okay. So for one of the problems, you'll actually be looking at magnetization as a function of the Monte Carlo driver.
Eric, when writing to files, I open a file, say one, and then I close at the end. But if I have two open and closed statements within one program, it only edits one file.
So when your program's